Okay, the recording has started. Just want to let you know that our opportunity this week, our learning in the shul this week has been graciously sponsored by Esty and Adam Cantor and family in memory of Beryl Ben Nachman Yisrael, Adam's father, who's currently commemorating his second Yahrzeit. And it's our sincere hope that the Divrei Torah that we offer tonight, can you hear me, Doc? Oh, no, you can't hear me. Okay, hold on one second. I apologize. My bad.
You're on
mute?
Oh, you said
we can hear. Yeah.
Tommy?
Yeah, I'm on mute.
Why are you on mute?
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, thank you for the heads up. We should be fine now. So as I mentioned before, Learning in the Shul this week is graciously sponsored by the Cantor family, Lili Nishmas, Beryl Ben Nachman Yisrael, that on the occasion of Adam's father's second Yahrzeit. And we hope that the learning that we do tonight, as well as all the learning that we continue to do in the shul, should serve L'Zchus Aliyas Neshama. You know, I've gotten some very nice feedback about the historical shiurim that we've been offering, and some of the people who are learning with us, some of the people who are listening online and catching up. So it's my sincere hope that, you know, the things we're going to do tonight and in the next 2 weeks should serve a little bit of an inspiration, and we'll sort of link back slightly and be a sort of a carry forward from our shiurim on Ukraine, which we talked about before Pesach time. I also have to begin with one last word of introduction, and that is a word of thanks. And the thanks I want to offer tonight is to Rabbi Stephen Przanski, formerly of B'nai Yeshurun in Teaneck, currently of Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Przanski is a dynamo, and he has so much wonderful Torah that he shared through all the years that he lived in the United States. Many of it is archived and always, always delivered. We've had him in the shul many times, but always delivered with like an excitement and a punch. And yeah, you know, and I was listening to something that he mentioned matter-of-factly. It stoked my idea, stoked my brain a little bit, got me thinking, and out came the three-part series that we're going to have. My dear friend, Mr. Salweis, should continue to be well. Has always challenged me on Hey ER, which it is right now, to make sure that there should be some form of commemoration, celebration, etc., of the wonderful gift that is Medinat Yisrael. And it is absolutely no question a wonderful gift. And no matter where we come and where we come from and where we're going and what our views are about the Medina, one view has to be very, very clear. And what must that view be? Thank God we have that Medina. Because if we didn't have the Medina, we would be in very, very serious difficulty. We'd have some serious problems in our lives, not only in the Medina, but beyond the Medina as well. And if you could just don't need to go any further than to see all the processing of all the people who are even somehow identifying as Jews coming out of the former Ukraine, and you will automatically know that there is some sort of issue that's going in and affecting them fantastically. And I think we've lost everyone again for a second. I'm having some problem with the Zoom because I'm being a character. Sorry that we keep having the... I'm sorry that I keep having these problems with the mute. Just give me... Somebody please just step up and tell me. You can hear me?
Yes.
Okay, sorry about the cutout. I think we fixed the problem. So I was just saying that, you know, well, along the way, one of the things that I think we have learned from the experience in Ukraine is that Ashrinu Matov Chalkeinu, how wonderful, how lucky we are that we have a Medina, that as a result of the Medina, people who are all over the world know that there is a place where Jews can go, and Jews have been coming, and they've been responded to, and it's been absolutely incredible. And so, you know, one of the big themes that has been drilled in me from the time I was a young man, a boy, was, as you may have heard from the word before Shabbos, was to develop a very strong appreciation for the Medina. And I learned two words that I never understood as a kid until I finally got into high school. It's a long story for another time. but that is the importance of being a religious Zionist. I used to have many, many debates with Rabbi Dr. Saul Roth as to who is a religious Zionist and what makes a religious Zionist, and what right does somebody who's living in Chutz La'aretz have to call himself a Zionist, all sorts of other exciting philosophical questions. And we agreed that we were going to have to disagree about the situation. He of course, continues to be an ardent Zionist. But before you get into the question of who is a religious Zionist, I think we need to ask the question, what is religious Zionism? And in order for us to figure out what is religious Zionism, I think the question, you know, sort of hangs different from which country in the diaspora you're coming from. It's easy to be a Zionist in Eretz Yisrael. You're living it, you're learning it, you're breathing it, your whole experience is an experience of Zionism. But when you're in Chutz La'aretz, where you're coming from may make a difference. There's a famous pasuk that the Navi declares, there'll be on that particular day a great shofar will be sounded. The ones who are lost will come back from Ashur, and the ones who've been knocked down will come back from Eretz Mitzrayim. And a question is asked by the commentaries, what's the difference between the Ovdim Eretz Ashur and the Nidachim in Eretz Mitzrayim? And the answer is, some people experience the tough galus, and so they're Nidachim. Some people are in a more comfortable galus. They are Ovdim, they've been lost, right? They need to find their own way. And so therefore, to be a religious Zionist fleeing Ukraine in this particular year, or to be a religious Zionist identifying in the United States of America, are two different experiences, and the approach of religious Zionism is also going to be two different parts. And one of my goals for this series is to help identify three different personalities who really contributed to the religious Zionist experience in the United States of America. And when I asked the question to a couple of my rabbinic friends, the two of the names that I asked for, who, when you think religious Zionism in the United States, who do you think of first? So everyone all, you know, many of my friends jumped up right away and said, Rav Soloveitchik. And we'll see that Rav Soloveitchik had, and the third of the parts of our class, we'll see Rav Soloveitchik certainly was a very towering figure of your religious Zionism, very different from religious Zionism in Israel. But we're also going to discover that he came from a background that was not religious Zionist. And when he first came to the United States, I don't think we would have called him a religious Zionist. And something changed within his mindset, and we see a massive difference in the way that he spoke. And we'll look at him in the third part. A couple of other people pointed out to another personality, a European fixture who wound up in Eretz Yisrael, and then later in the United States, and then back in Eretz Yisrael. His name was Rabbi Dr. Meir Bar Ilan, or Rabbi Dr. Meir Berlin. He was the younger son of the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, and he is the namesake for a famous university in Givat Ram, known as Bar Ilan University. And we're going to see that he was also, actually, quite likely, if you're going to be debating the question who the father of American religious Zionism is, I think just by sheer age, Rav Bar Ilan is going to certainly take precedence before Rabbi Soloveitchik. But if you really want the honest, God's honest truth, the father of religious Zionism in the United States, in this comment, you know, where I think was hinted to a certain degree by Rabbi Przanski, although he didn't go this way, I'll say it because I heard it in the name of Bibi Netanyahu, who pointed it out in an introduction to one of his works, one of his books. The real father of religious Zionism was actually not Jewish. And again, the person I'm referring to was a man named William Blackstone, or more correctly and more properly titled, the Reverend William Blackstone. He, if I may, is the true father of religious Zionism in the United States of America. Now, what right? That's a little bit of a chutzpah if we go with a certain definition of religious Zionism. But nobody said that we had to directly identify which religion I was talking about. So let's figure out who was William Eugene Blackstone. William Eugene Blackstone may not have only been the father of religious Zionism, he may actually be the father of Zionism. Now, when we think of the father of Zionism, we often identify the father of Zionism as Theodor Herzl. Of course, since we went through the discussion of the role of Tzionim versus non-Tzionim in Ukraine, we learned about Mr. Pinsker, right? Who is very much the father, well before there was a Theodor Herzl. Well before both of them, there was the Reverend William Blackstone. The Reverend William Eugene Blackstone was born on October 6th in 1841. So we're talking well before the Herzl's dreams. And he was an American evangelist, and he was a Christian Zionist. Now, contemporary historians almost totally ignore, forget, or even deliberately marginalize Blackstone, both in Zionist and in American history. Now, I can understand why we do that in American history, because American history is often blocked off by the anti-Zionist pro-Palestinian sources. So to be able to turn around and talk about Reverend Blackstone, who was a major contributor, we're going to see he had a major political impact on American history, right? We're going to see why he was taken out. We're going to see why people didn't want to include him in American history. Blackstone was born in Adams, New York, and he was an evangelical Christian when he was 11 years old. Why? Because he was hanging around as an 11-year-old, and he went to revival meetings at the local Methodist church. And he enlisted for the military during the American Civil War, right? And he tried to get accepted, and unfortunately, he did not have the strongest of bodies. So he was rejected due to what they called frailness of body, and they would not let him join the army, I assume the Union Army, and instead he decides to join the United States Christian Commission. The Christian Commission was, during the Civil War, the equivalent of what we would call the Red Cross today without all the politics, right? And it was stationed most of the time at General Grant's headquarters, and Blackstone was given the job of being the coordinator of medical services for injured combatants. So basically, he was the Hawkeye Pierce of the, or I would say the Colonel Potter, if I may put it, not of the Korean War, but of the Civil War. And in 1870, where he was very successful, he had been successfully involved in the business of building and property investments, he had started to develop himself on his own. But in 1870, and one night, he seemed to have experienced some sort of personal spiritual struggle, and he wakes up and he makes the decision that he's dedicating his life to God. And so he decides, I'm not going to be interested in material pursuits anymore. And he says for the rest of his life, this is what he's going to do. And he decides to go ahead and preach throughout the United States. And in his writing as well, he decides that the main focus of his ministry is going to be the premillennial return and rapture of the church. That is to say, his goal was to make sure that the ultimate of the church is going to be seen. And as he's ministering across the United States, Blackstone keeps talking more and more and more about supporting this concept he calls Jewish Restorationism. What's Jewish Restorationism? Jewish Restorationism is the idea that the Jews need to go back to the Holy Land in order for them to go ahead and have a prelude to their conversion to Christianity out of a pious wish to make sure that they bring along their Messiah. And this is his mission. And he's running around the United States, and he's telling all the people in the United States, the Jews, we got to send them back to Israel. We got to find them from all over the world. And the United States, the people in the United States, and we're talking in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, the roaring 90s, the government was doing, you know, the economy was building, it was moving in a certain direction, and people are listening, and then all of a sudden he realizes, he starts listening to what's going on in Europe, and he becomes concerned because he starts hearing about these deadly government-instigated pogroms all over Russia and Ukraine. And he believes that all of a sudden, maybe not just because of Restorationism, but also because these Jews are getting slaughtered. And he says, we got to get the Jews out of Russia and Ukraine. Sound familiar? Right? And he turns around and he says, we have to give them a homeland. And he decides he's going to give them a homeland in Israel. And he was therefore, and he was also persuaded that both the European nations and the United States, you know, we have to give them a homeland because nobody else wants them. The European nations didn't want these Jews coming out of Russia and Ukraine. They were backward. They were uncouth. They were all these other... And the United States had immigration quotas. This is the end of the 1800s that he was talking about. And so he says, if you're not going to give them a place to live here, let's get them a place to live in their own homeland, right? And so he says this is going to be his mission. And in 1888, Blackstone and his daughter decide they're going to go to Israel. So in 1888, they go to visit Israel. They start traveling around Israel. I'm pretty sure they didn't get to stay in the King David. I'm pretty sure that they, you know, the things were not as gorgeous as they are today. And he comes back with this tremendous fervor, with an understanding that the return of the Jewish people to its ancient homeland was the only way that Jews are going to be able to get past their persecution that they're suffering everywhere else. And on November, around Thanksgiving, November 24th, 25th, 1890, he decides he's going to go ahead and create a special conference. And he calls this the Conference on the Past, Present, and Future of Israel. And he organizes it at the First Methodist Episcopal Church in Chicago. Right, take a look at this. This is where Zionism is born in the United States in 1890. Right, and who's there? The participants are leaders of both the Jewish and the Christian communities. But clearly, there's one movement among the Jewish people who are clearly not involved. And which movement is that? The Reform Movement. Why the Reform Movement? Because one of the tenets in the Reform Movement is that they don't believe v'sechazena inenu b'shuvcha l'tzion. The idea of having a Zionist doctrine is rejected by the Reform Movement. And so he realizes there's not going to be any reform. And so the conference decides, what is the practical result of the conference? So the conference decides to issue a call telling the great powers, including the Ottomans, who at that time were in control of what was to be Israel, to return Israel to the Jews. And they put out a bunch of resolutions of sympathy for oppressed Jews living in Russia. And Blackstone says, thank you very much for nice words, but words don't mean anything. And so Blackstone turns around and he says, just writing resolutions, even resolutions that are signed by big people, that's not going to be enough. Instead, what do we need to do? He says, we have to really push very strongly for the voluntary resettlement of the Jewish people who are suffering because of the United States. We have to get them to get into Israel. And so in 1891, Blackstone issues something that has become known in history. Look it up. I did. It's a worthwhile adventure. He issues something known as the Blackstone Memorial. The Blackstone Memorial is not to be found in Washington, D.C., among the Lincoln and the Jefferson Memorial. The Blackstone Memorial is a document that was signed by 413 prominent Christian and a couple of Jewish leaders in the United States. Who are among the lucky signatures? Well, we have people like John D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, Cyrus McCormick. We had a bunch of senators and congressmen and religious leaders of all sorts of denominations. We've got newspaper editors, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Everyone signs the Blackstone Memorial. And this memorial gets presented to the President of the United States of America at the time, President Harrison, Benjamin Harrison, in March in 1891, and he calls for American support of Jewish restoration to Israel. And his petition, this Blackstone Memorial, is actually a prelim before the World Zionist Congress, which was led by Theodore Herzl. And so we have this Blackstone Memorial. And in it, there are a bunch of exciting comments that are made. Let me quote for a couple of seconds. Why shall not the powers which under the Treaty of Berlin in 1878 gave Bulgaria to the Bulgarians and Serbia to the Serbians, not now give Palestine back to the Jews? These provinces, as well as Romania, Montenegro, and Greece, were wrested from the Turks and given to their natural owners. Does not Israel rightfully belong to the Jews? And so the counter-argument was, but the Jews lost the war. And so Blackstone writes in the Blackstone Memorial, he says, the law of dereliction doesn't apply to the Jews, for, quote, they never abandoned the land. They made no treaty. They did not even surrender. They simply succumbed. After the most desperate conflict, to the overwhelming power of the Romans, end quote. And so this gets brought to Harrison on March 5th, 1891, and this memorial makes it into the news, and it's in the American news for weeks. In fact, so serious is this document, the entire thing gets published start to finish in the Chicago Daily Tribune, which is pretty serious at the time, right? It would be the equivalent of having discovered who knows what with panels all over cable TV. And so Harrison gets the memorial, and he receives Reverend Blackstone very seriously. Harrison was a pretty religious guy, albeit not a Methodist, and the Blackstone Memorial gets recognized as being very politically important, so Harrison decides, I can't just shrug it off. And the memorial tells Harrison to consider the condition of the Israelites and their claim to Palestine as their ancient home, and to promote, in all other just and proper ways, the alleviation of their suffering condition. So he switched away from restoration, and now he's focusing on what? Curbing anti-Semitism. And Harrison's a pragmatist. He's not much of a religious guy, and he sees the limitations of American power. Remember, America was not a world power at this point in time. And he sees that, what, he starts to pigeonhole the focus of the memorial, and he finds some, uses some diplomatic efforts to sort of get the Tsar to sort of lower the pressure on the Jews. And he mentions in his third State of the Union address, he actually mentions the suffering of the Russian Jews because it was such major news, so he couldn't let it go by. Well, Blackstone's efforts continue, and Harrison winds up basically being in office for a short period of time. He gets followed by Cleveland, and Blackstone keeps presenting the document again and again and again and again. And he presents it to Theodore Roosevelt. But you know what happens when Teddy Roosevelt gets a hold of the same Blackstone Memorial? He's even less receptive than Harrison was. And so Harrison's effort at stirring American political support through the presidential politics, it sort of fades into the background. But it never leaves Blackstone's head. He understands that he has to the fact of influencing the president may have failed, but he realizes he's got to do something else. And so Blackstone becomes a very ardent supporter of Zionism. And so when Zionism sort of crops up in the Herzl mind, Blackstone starts paying very close attention. He's got very similar ideas to his ideas. Well, one of the things that really tipped Zionism at one point was an offer by the British. Do you remember what the British offered? So Doc will tell you that the British turned to Herzl and said, we'll give the Jews a homeland, but not in Israel. We're going to give them a little country. Very good, Dr. Wegger, right? Very good. Hey, we're going to give it to them in Uganda, right? Which would have made the raid on Entebbe kind of obsolete, but certainly not worth it, right? And so Herzl is seriously considering it, and he gets a note from Blackstone, don't do it, right? And he sends Herzl a personal Bible outlining the specific importance to restoring the Jews to Israel only. And they say that Bible was supposed to be on Herzl's desk for many, many years, though nobody can find it anymore. So if you look at old pictures of Herzl, you will find that there's a Bible there, but you will not see it now. Who else gets very stoked by this whole experience? Louis Brandeis. You know, the Supreme Court's in the news a lot these days. Well, the Supreme Court was in the news a lot then because Louis Brandeis, he was being involved in the congressional appointment hearings for himself, and he discovers the Blackstone Memorial in 1916 during his congressional appointment hearings. You should just know, those congressional appointment hearings for Louis Brandeis were quite anti-Semitic. And Brandeis, who was at that time the head of the American Zionist movement, uses another individual, Nathan Strauss, you may remember him, like as in Macy's, you know. And Strauss turns around and brings Brandeis to understand the Blackstone Memorial of 1891, and Strauss pushes a meeting between Blackstone and Brandeis to make them aware of one another. So Strauss writes to Blackstone in 1916, and he says, listen, Mr. Brandeis is perfectly infatuated with the work that you did over Zionism, and it would have done your heart good to have him heard, to have heard him assert with a valuable what a valuable contribution to the cause your document is. In fact, he agrees. This is Strauss speaking about Brandeis to Jews, to Reverend Blackstone. He says, he agrees with me that you're the father of Zionism, because your work antedates Herzl's. You came first. So Herzl's getting all this credit. You should just know, Strauss says, you're the father of Zionism. And since, you know, Blackstone was a religious guy, so Schwartz, sitting here in his front of his computer, says, I guess that makes Blackstone the first religious Zionist, at least in the United States. And so Brandeis then turns around and follows up, and he says, Blackstone, you got to go ahead and you have to, this is 1916, the original, it's already, you know, 26 years after the original came out. So he says, you know what you have to do, he says to him? You need to put up a more modern Blackstone memorial, and you got to get it to Woodrow Wilson, who was the president in 1916. And he says, if you can go ahead, because what's Brandeis thinking? The Jewish power in 1916 was not a very strong power in the United States. But the Jewish power, together with grassroots American Christian power, that would have led to quite a bit of American political support. And Brandeis also thought that if Blackstone could raise for the memorial, it might actually get Wilson to go ahead and accept and endorse American Zionism, and another document that was being debated in England at the time. You remember what that document was called? Doc? The famous Balfour Declaration. And so sure enough, he wants, and that document, there you have it open in front of you, right? That document, the Balfour Declaration, certainly served as the backbone from which the State of Israel would later emerge. I remember Shachter once told me, when we asked him about saying Halal on Yom HaAtzmaut, I have it in writing somewhere here, I was in Israel, and he said there were many Gedolim who thought that it wasn't about saying Halal on Yom HaAtzmaut, it was about the words Reshit Smichat Gulatenu. So he said there were many who were of the opinion that Reshit Smichat Gulatenu, the beginning of the blossoming of our redemption. And Rabbi Shatzer said, many thought that the signing of the Balfour Declaration, just Balfour Day in and of itself, should be identified as Reshit Smichat Gulatenu. Well, here, you know, Louis Brandeis was not a religious man at all, but identifiably Jewish, right, is urging Blackstone to try to use the Christian influence to be able to pressure Wilson into sort of supporting the Balfour Declaration. And Blackstone, who's 75 years old at the time, decides, you know what, this is a good project for me. And so he turns around and even gets the Presbyterian Church. Now, you know why that's ironic today, but he gets the Presbyterian Church to sign on to his new modern version, 1916 modern version of the Blackstone Memorial. And Wilson is of the, he is a religiously observant Presbyterian. And so, and even though the Blackstone Memorial of 1916 is presented to Wilson only privately, it sort of gets American support for the Balfour Declaration. You should just know the 1916 version of the Blackstone Memorial does not get publicly presented with the same fanfare that the original of 1890 gets instead. Why was the Blackstone Memorial never formally publicly presented? Because part of the petition in this 1916 document called upon the nations of the world to set up an international conference to resolve the Jewish problem. That term would unfortunately become known as something else not too long thereafter. But the United States government and the British, as the control of the of what would be in the land of Israel, then called Palestine after World War I, it was not what the two countries wanted. And so therefore, they didn't put it in at that point in time. Whatever it is, by 1917, the Balfour Declaration is still hanging in the balance. And the British cabinet of Lloyd George demanded a statement of support from the Americans, without which the Balfour Declaration was going to fail. And that statement came on October 16, 1917, but it came with a condition. And what was the condition? On October 16th, the British intelligence chief wires London. Colonel House put the formula before the president, who approves of it, but asks that no mention of his approval shall be made within his when His Majesty's government makes the formula public. As he had arranged, the American Jews shall then ask him for approval, which he will probably give here. So Wilson wanted the Jews to come and ask him after the King of England will come ahead and formalize it. And part of the problem was that Wilson had some reservations about the text of the Declaration. He didn't have a problem with the intent. And we know the rest of the history. The Balfour Declaration was issued on November 2, 1917, and on June 30th, 1922, United States Congress issued the following statement. They resolved by the Senate and the House of Representatives, the United States of America and Congress assembled, that the United States favors the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which should prejudice the civil and religious rights of Christians and all other non-Jewish communities in Palestine, and that the holy places and religious buildings and sites in Palestine shall be adequately protected. And at the American Zionist Conventions in Philly and Los Angeles in 1919 and 1920, Blackstone was singled out for honor because of his contribution to the Zionist world. So here we have it, the original religious Zionist in the United States of America and perhaps the world is William Blackstone. A lot of his stuff, a lot of his achievements are things that we sit down here, scratch our heads and shake our heads and say, wow, way to go, we agree with those things, right? And we take a look at the way Israel shaped up. You know, it was wonderful. Is there anything we can take away from the experience? Because there are a lot of people going to listen to our shiur, maybe some of the people here tonight, who are going to turn around and say, oh my gosh, are you really seriously saying that the concept of religious Zionism is built on Christianity? God forbid. That's not my point whatsoever. My point is that the tenets of religious Zionism were even understood by those who were not necessarily from our religion. William Blackstone galvanized it. You know, sometimes we're able to say, I was thinking about this tonight, and I was saying, sometimes we're very wonderfully gifted, where we say zacha, where we say that when we merit it, malachta nasa al yedei acherim, the work that we need to do can be done by those around us. We certainly also know that sometimes it happens that when God brings geula, sometimes he likes to bring it through the hands of those who are perhaps not from our ilk. When the Jews left Egypt, they left berachush gadol, right? And they were able to get the support there within. And certainly we find throughout history, when the Jews came back, in any time there was a yitziyah migalut l'cheirut, even in the beginning of the Second Temple era, take a look at Sefer Ezra, look at Sefer Nehemiah, you'll see that when the Jews came back, they came back with support of the non-Jews. But this does lead to a certain discussion and question. And it's a practical, there's one very practical, hotly debated issue in halacha today that results, I believe, directly from the efforts and the history of Reverend William Blackstone. And that is, how much use can we make of the religious intents of those next to us who share our religion, who share our goal, but for a different purpose? So let's look at Blackstone for a minute. Blackstone believed in restorationism, at least initially. And so therefore, he was very pro, you know, getting the Jews back to Israel. In modern evangelical works as well, there are organizations that will pay you to have aliyah. And the shaila has been asked, even in our own community, am I allowed to take a grant from a non-Jewish source for the purposes of aliyah? Now, this is a hotly debated issue among modern poskim. I put it out all week this week among my group of rabbinic friends, and I received some very interesting citations and sources. Not surprisingly, many in the what we would call the Dati Leumi, the religious Zionist camp in Israel, said, look, The evangelicals do not directly attach a religious significance, nor do they expect anything from those they gift with the opportunity. They don't. They contribute money, and it's no different than taking money from the United States of America to the government of Israel. Everything flows from one place to another place. That by the time the tzedakah gets to the people, it's not even identifiable. And so, therefore, great poskim in the Dati Lumi world have absolutely no difficulty with accepting the money. Rav Yashiv, we saw last night, Rav Yashiv in a tshuva in Kovetz Tshuvos, is anyway very concerned anytime somebody takes a tzedakah from a non-Jew directly. It speaks badly about the Jewish community and the Jewish community's ability to take care of its needs. Still, Rav Yashiv notes that if it's not direct, in other words, it's not from hand to hand, and it's done in a more global way, and it's not done where a person is going to get the wrong impression and start celebrating, there may be a different grounds from within which a person is able to go ahead and proceed. And certainly, you know, again, without getting into the specifics of each and every case, a lot of these grant opportunities that exist, although coming from evangelical organizations, they do not represent any and do not require the people to have any sort of religious contact. They believe that what they're doing is providing. And so whether one can accept and partake is a very exciting shaila, and each case has to be asked to the posig that the person is asking. But it certainly is a direct line to the origins of religious Zionism, that a direct line being, of course, the legacy of the late Reverend William Blackstone, the one I believe clearly deserves the title Father of Religious Zionism in the United States of America. Please God, next week we will meet Rav Meir Bar Ilan, the young kid, the amazing kid who grew up to be an amazing force. We'll learn about Bnei Akiva and Mizrahi and all the effects that came about as a result of his efforts. And in 2 weeks' time, Be'ezrat Hashem, in honor of the period in time of Lag BaOmer, we will also identify Rav Soloveitchik, and we'll learn what the effects war had on changing people from one side of thinking over to another. I want to take the opportunity to wish everyone, whether you keep a Dalet Iyar or Hey Iyar, Mo'adim L'Simcha L'Gula Shleima, and may we experience a true Geula, B'mehra V'Yameinu.